Good evening. Welcome to the 2008 season of Points of View programs. I'd like to open with an announcement that all of this season's programs are going to be recorded for possible podcasting. So you will notice that my introduction will include those who are not in this room and maybe listening at a different time. That said, I'm Mary Wood for the San Francisco Ballet Center for Dance Education, and it's my pleasure to be here with you this evening, Wednesday, January 30th, 2008, in the green room of the Veterans Building in San Francisco. Our Points of View lecture series, along with the Meet the Artist pre-performance interviews and various other educational programming, are produced by the San Francisco Ballet Center for Dance Education, directed by Charles Chip McNeil, and administered by Cecilia Beam. Many of these lectures and interviews will be podcast, and I encourage you to go to the San Francisco Ballet website, sfballet.org, to catch a program that you might have missed or to review one that you especially liked. As always, it's a pleasure to see old friends and familiar faces in this group. I offer a welcome to all newcomers and to those of you listening via podcast. To you newcomers, I might just say, in these programs, we attempt to present interesting, informative, possibly entertaining, bits of background and inside information from the point of view of someone who has a seat behind the scenes. And that might be a ballet master, a musician, a dancer, or an artistic director. All of this is in the hope that when you go to the ballet, you'll have an enhanced appreciation for the performance that you see. You can hardly have escaped the fact that this is a very big year for San Francisco Ballet. And so now I can say welcome to the San Francisco Ballet's 75th anniversary season. San Francisco Ballet, as America's oldest professional company, is 75 years old. And the season has been filled with special events, both on and off stage, to commemorate this landmark milestone. Those of you who were fortunate enough to see last week's gala saw a number of visiting former principal dancers from the recent past as well as from quite a distant past in our history. Looking ahead, the weekend of March 14th, 15th, and 16th is designated Alumni Weekend, and there has been a tremendous effort to gather alumni from across the 75 years who will converge on the Opera House and the Ballet Building during that weekend for all kinds of events, and I'm sure there will be the opportunity for a whole lot of historical stargazing during intermissions at performances that weekend. I want to call your attention to, if you haven't noticed it, the book. I'm holding up the book. This is San Francisco Ballet at 75, written by dance scholar and historian Janice Ross. The book also includes a DVD, which is worth the price of the book. It has hours of, feels like hours, it's about an hour of absolutely marvelous historical archival footage dating back the 75 years of the company. A number of special exhibitions have been mounted. I would call your attention, those of you who travel hither and thither, to a couple of exhibits at the San Francisco Airport, both in the International Terminal and, I believe, in Terminal 3. The Museum of Performance and Design, important, this is formerly SF Palm, as you know, housed in the upper floors of this building. The Museum of Performance and Design is producing several events, and those projects include an exhibition on the history of dance in California that will travel to various Bay Area education and arts institutions. They're also producing a two-part exhibition in the War Memorial Opera House lobby, and if you've been this week already, I highly recommend it. There are some marvelous little bits of history in the cases in the lobby. All of this is, of course, tied to this anniversary season. And then the exhibition in the Opera House will be set up for touring as the company travels on an American tour. I'll say a little more about that in a moment. And then, of course, in the Museum of Performance and Design upstairs, there will also be special commemorative exhibits. So lots to see. I would, of course, probably mention that Channel 11, NBC 11, is the official television station. All of the news and updates can be found there, and all of this can be tracked on the company's wonderful website, sfballet.org, that has a special feature for anniversary events and things to look for. So I know you'll want to find that. We know that the company has triumphed in performances abroad in recent years, has traveled around the United States, a little bit here, a little bit there. But this fall, the company embarks on its first in a long time American tour. They will go to four cities presenting a total of 32 performances, starting in mid-September in Chicago, going to New York City Center in October, finishing up in Orange County, and then at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. in November before returning home to Nutcracker. And speaking of Nutcracker, performances last December were filmed, as you might have already heard, and that will be broadcast on PBS during this coming holiday season. Watch your local listings, as they say. And this performing season concludes with a Words Fail Me, Simply Spectacular Festival of New Works. More about that later. So now I think if we'll dim the lights, we'll begin to look at some images. I want to start by talking about the new dancers that you will see. These will, of course, highlight dancers new to the company and dancers from within the company who were promoted and who you will see in new roles. We mentioned last spring the promotion, still during the season, of both Sarah Van Patten and Rachel Vaselli to the status of principal. A guest artist this year is Sofiane Sylvie. She has performed most recently with New York City Ballet, comes from companies throughout Europe, and some of you were lucky enough to see her during the gala performance, and we'll watch for her throughout the season. Maria Kochakova comes to the company most recently from the English National Ballet. She was trained at the Bolshoi School in Russia, danced both with the Russian State Ballet and the Royal Ballet before joining the English National and coming to San Francisco this year. Here she is with Principal David Karapetyan. And then promotions. One of our favorite dancers from the Corps, James Sifranco, has been elevated to the role of soloist. And here he is in the Nutcracker. We have new dancers to the company in the soloist ranks. Julianne Kepley, trained at the Atlanta Ballet School, the School of American Ballet, danced with the Atlanta Ballet for a long time, joined the Joffrey Ballet, and comes to us from there. And here she is in Nutcracker. Matteo Klemeyer comes to us from Germany, where he was trained at Essen-Werden and Hamburg. He has danced in other companies around the world, including the Boston Ballet, the Zurich Ballet, and the Birmingham Royal. And there he is in the Nutcracker. There are a number of new dancers in the Corps de Ballet, and I will just spin through their pictures. Gaetano Amico, Clara Blanco, Ludmila Campos, Charlene Cohen, Damir Emmerich, Sasha De Sola, Adeline Kaiser, Christopher Mondu, Ashley Mwangmatong, Kendall Teague, Aubert Vanderlinden, Luke Willis, and a bunch of apprentices, and I'm pleased to say some of them have come up through San Francisco Ballet's trainee program. Some of you are familiar with that. We may hear more about that later tonight. Owen Guy, Sean Orza, Jeremy Rucker, and Sarah Walburn. And of course, as those dancers appear throughout the season, we'll hope we can point them out in some of the slides that we'll be fortunate enough to have. So now I would like to just fly through the season coming up, which is, I hope you're all just feeling the excitement. It's going to be quite amazing. I'm actually going to skip over program one for the moment and move on to program two. Divertimento number 15 was revived last year, so it will be familiar. Here are Rachel Vaselli, Katita Waldo, and Nicolai Blanc. And all of the principal dancers. It is one of Balanchine's tutu ballets, to Mozart's Divertimento number 15. It will be fun to see this again. The company has not done it in a number of years. Drink to Me Only with Thine Eyes, choreographed by Mark Morris, originally for American Ballet Theater, and to piano studies of Virgil Thompson. And in the tradition of piano ballets, the piano will be on stage. These are rehearsal shots. We didn't have any existing performance shots. And there's the piano as it will be featured on stage. A revival of last year's premiere of Yuri Posikoff's Firebird to the music of Stravinsky, the classic, classic score, the Firebird. Pascal Molat as the Kashi, and Yuan Yuan Tan as the Firebird. And of course, Firebird photos are all over town. You can't miss this one. Program 3 offers this season's full-length classic, Helgi Thomasson's Giselle. Kristen Long and Gennady Nedvin in the first act, and Tina LeBlanc and Gonzalo Garcia in the second act. And of course, one of the reasons for doing this work is the incredible gift of the Corps de Ballet in the second act. Program 4 is going to be sensational. We have a revival of Fancy Free, which the company premiered last year. Here's Pascal Molat as one of the sailors, the music of Bernstein, the choreography of Jerome Robbins. And it's interesting because this picture exists from almost every production of this ballet, dating back to its premiere in 1944. It's a photo op from the ballet. And then also on this program, which features works by Jerome Robbins, will be from his other world, the world of romantic ballet in the night to the nocturnes of Chopin. And then, what we're all waiting for, the West Side Story Suite. Conceived by Jerome Robbins, assisted by Peter Gennaro, to the music of Leonard Bernstein. And you wonder why we've mentioned the lyrics by Stephen Sondheim. It's because the dancers will be singing. And I hear they're having a wonderful time. So look forward to hearing more about that. And here are some rehearsal shots from West Side Story Suite. I mean, does that look like fun or what? Program 5 is actually the company's last standard repertory program on the season. And we will start with The Carousel, a dance created by Christopher Wheeldon to the immortal music of Richard Rodgers. Here we have Sarah Van Patten with Pierre-François Villanova. Finally, the Pas de Deux from After the Rain. Some of you saw it on a gala a year ago, and it is one of the most stunning works. We're really looking forward to this. This is Yuan Yuan Tan with Damian Smith. Also to the choreography of Christopher Wheeldon. And then an encore presentation of the sensation from last season, Eden, Eden, choreographed by Wayne McGregor to music of Steve Wright. And I'm sure those of you who saw it last year remember how startling and stunning, but ultimately irresistible it was. This program features a premiere by Helgi Thomasson. We know that the music is the Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini by Rachmaninoff. And the program notes have quotes from Helgi about the piece. I'm sure that it is in the neoclassic style, and I know that it will be very romantic. Anyone who knows that music will not be surprised to hear that. We have no pictures. Yet. One of the very exciting things that will be happening this season, and it's a very practical thing logistically, because of the Festival of New Works, to be mentioned in a moment, coming down the pike, the company needs time to take a break and prepare. And as a tribute to San Francisco Ballet in this 75th anniversary season, three companies, international companies, have been invited and have volunteered to come and pay tribute. They are the National Ballet of Canada, the New York City Ballet, and Le Ballet de Monte Carlo. And so Program 6 will be the tribute to SFB by the visiting companies. The first piece we'll see is, interestingly, entitled A Delicate Battle. The choreographer, Matyash Murzewski, created a work for San Francisco Ballet that was seen last year. And these are photographs from his work that will be danced by the National Ballet of Canada. Also on the program, Duo Concertant, a pas de deux to the music of Stravinsky, the violin concerto by Stravinsky, choreographed by George Balanchine for the Stravinsky Festival in 1972, and danced by a couple from the New York City Ballet. And then the program concludes with Altro Canto, choreographed by Jean-Christophe Maillot, to the music of Monteverdi. And it will be quite a treat for us to be able to see dancers from around the world performing works by choreographers that San Francisco Ballet also performs. And now I have come around in a circle to Program 1. Program 1 is an extremely fitting opening to this 75th anniversary season. Not in order. The middle piece, 7 for 8, was created by Helgi Thomasson in 2004. It is a piece, it is a choreographed work of 7 pieces of music by Bach, keyboard music by Bach, for 8 dancers. Here is Elizabeth Miner and Jaime Castilla. And I think that's Nutneray with a mystery partner. Pierre-François, perhaps. Neoclassical in style, romantic in tone, representing very nearly the present in San Francisco Ballet history. diamonds from George Balanchine's Jewels. You might recall that Jewels was created in 1967 as the first full-length abstract or plotless ballet. Three sections, each dedicated to a different jewel, each using a different piece of music, each representing a different phase in the life, the artistic life of George Balanchine. The middle section, entitled Rubies, is the music of Stravinsky and represents the American era and influence in the life of Balanchine. The first section, Emeralds, the music is Fauré, the tone is very French, and that represents a middle period in Balanchine's life before he came to America. And the finale of this full-length ballet is Diamonds. The music is Tchaikovsky, and the tribute is Balanchine's Imperial Russian heritage. And what could be more imperial than the elegance of a classical pas-de-deux? Here is Yuan Yuan Tan in a picture from an earlier production, actually, with partner Zachary Hench, who is no longer with the company. And then opening... Oh, I'm sorry, there's another lovely picture of the corps de ballet. Diamonds is the quintessential Imperial Russian ballet with a very large corps de ballet, a feature of a string of soloists, and the glamorous ballerina and cavalier as principals. And here we are at Filling Station. Filling Station was created by San Francisco Ballet's artistic director emeritus, Lou Christensen, in 1938. The premiere was danced by Lou himself. The work was not created for San Francisco Ballet, but it entered San Francisco Ballet's repertoire in the 1950s. This is Lou Christensen. It'll be on the cover of this season's program. And here are San Francisco Ballet dancers of the present rehearsing the work, which had its opening performance last night. We're going to do a little experiment. We're going to show you a video clip that talks about Filling Station, shows us some clips of Filling Station from times gone by. I do want to point out that it is an old, old, old recording of a recording of a recording, and the sound will not be great. So just focus on what you can see.
The most important of Christensen's early works was Filling Station, a 1938 unpretentious roadside fable. It is generally hailed to be the first ballet entirely designed, composed, choreographed, and performed by Americans. Paul Cadmus designed the boldly scaled set in the neon and chrome fantasy of 30s American pop, while his costumes, which included startling see-through cellophane overalls, evoked the humor of American comic strips. The entire ballet intentionally evoked the kind of world Jimmy Cagney might be at home in. The commission score, featuring everything from movie chase music to honky-tonk rhythms, was by the noted American composer Virgil Thompson.
Blink and Kirstein asked us both if we would like to do a ballet. And I think the subject matter of this ballet actually was Lincoln's. Why, it's an evening in the life of a filling station attendant. He listens to the radio, and various people come in for their needs. A couple of truck drivers that go by regularly come in, and there's a family of a man and wife and a rather nasty little girl. She has to go to the toilet. Then there's a young couple, a little bit drunk. They've come from a dance at the local country club. In the midst of all this, a gangster comes in and holds up the place. And so the filling station turns out the light. We have a whole dance in the dark with the flashlights.
With flashlights, yeah.
Yes, yes. When the lights are turned on again, the gangster has been arrested by state troopers.
That's right.
And the girl from the country club is dead as a doornail.
Filling Station was a salute to pop culture, the American answer to Swan Lake and Sleeping Beauty, with Mac the Mechanic as a workaday Prince Charming. As Mac, Christensen dazzled audiences with speed and virtuosity.
I think that the whole point of these ballets that were done for the caravan was to bring the American public into the theater, not just those few who loved to see Swan Lake and loved to see Sophie. They wanted to catch a whole new audience, and Filling Station did it, because if a woman could drag her husband there, he went out laughing his head off, and he was willing again to come to the ballet.
Filling Station was the first in a series of...
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed that. And when you get a chance to see Filling Station, the context is just going to be perfect. So moving on. This incredible New Works Festival. At the end of the season, the company will present 10 world premieres by these choreographers: Julia Adam, Val Cannaparoli, Yorma Elo, Margaret Jenkins, James Kudelka, Mark Morris, Yuri Posikoff, Paul Taylor, Stanton Welsh, and Christopher Whieldon. The only one whose work will be new to the company and to, I believe, Bay Area audiences is Yorma Elo. The company has been working on these pieces since last summer. They're going to be polishing them up while the visiting companies are performing Program 6. And then on April 22nd, it's going to start. And in 3 days, the company will present the 10 new works, which will then be repeated over a period of 2 weeks. Everyone's pretty excited. So I hope you're all planning to just line up and see each one. We, of course, don't have any staged pictures, and these are in no particular order, but I'm just going to flip through, hoping that you'll catch some of the excitement of doing these new works. These are all from just from rehearsals. As I said, no particular order, and in some, the choreographer might be in the picture, most not. I hope that, as I said, I hope that will absolutely pique your interest. I'm going to make this presentation about tonight's guest. I am just tickled to death that we have with us this evening a member of the San Francisco Ballet family who is very much an important figure in the present, but who has the gift of spanning a great deal of the company's history. Jim Soam is a former principal dancer with the company and is currently the administrative manager of the San Francisco Ballet School, an extraordinarily significant entity in the larger institution. Before we actually bring Jim up to visit with me and us, I would like to show, first of all, this wonderful picture of Jim. I don't know if he knew that we were going to show this picture. Is it of Divertimento number 15? So I don't know how we managed to pull that picture out, but there it is, a ballet that's on this season's repertoire. The school dancers were featured in the gala last week, performing a work that they will perform at the end of this season, and I would like to start now and, as the season goes by, offer a plug for the San Francisco Ballet School Showcase that will take place in mid-May, and Jim will probably say a little more about that. But these are some pictures of today's San Francisco Ballet School students, and I hope you'll agree, it's pretty sensational. And now, if we can bring the lights back up, I would like to invite Jim to come join me. While we cover our housekeeping here just slightly, get settled in, I want to say, Jim, thank you so much and welcome. And it's just a treat to be able to be with someone who I've known for a very long time and who does span quite a bit of this history. I hope that you'll take that as a compliment.
Thank you, I do, and it's a pleasure to be here. So let's get on.
Let's get on with it. Oh, thank you. I would be lost without my notes. Jim is in a position to talk about just about everything, but I thought we would narrow it down to talking about his history and, by extension, the history of the company, to talking about his experience as a cast member of Filling Station, to talk about your career transition, really, into a little bit of an unusual transition for the folks who I talk to a lot, and that is into administration, and then to talk about this fabulous school we have and the relationship of the company to the school. So let's back up and talk about history. I don't want you to feel like an artifact, but I realize that you have had a relationship of some kind with the all three Christensen brothers, Willem, Harold, and Lou, with Michael Smuin, and with Helgi Thomason.
That is correct. I joined the company in 1975 when I was 19 years old, and at that time, Harold was in his last year as director of the school. Lou Christensen was director of the company along with his associate director mm-hmm. or assistant, or mm-hmm. there were many title changes along the way, but we always called him Director Michael Smuin. Also, during that period, we did a revival of a work of Willem Christensen called Nothing Doin' Bar, and Willem came out from Salt Lake City, and I was I'm very proud to have been a part of that. It was a wonderful experience, so I got to work directly with Willem on that project, as well as when we did the new Nutcracker, the
86.
Verona production in 86. Mm-hmm. The party scene that you might remember from that is actually Willem's choreography, and he came out and staged that and worked on that then. So I had a second opportunity to work with him. And as well, I was here in the company in 1985 when Helgi assumed the role of artistic director, and now I'm working in his school.
So there's, I'm sure you hold an incredible number of anecdotes. You probably have some observations to make about the way the company has grown, changes in direction perhaps, changes in emphasis. Talk about, let's just keep this to a few sentences. The character of the company back when you joined in 1975, as it has grown into the company that we have today?
Well, first of all, in 1975 when I joined the company, I think I was probably the 38th member of the company. So it was about half of what it is now. We were doing, I believe, about five subscription programs in the Opera House. We were sharing the house with the Symphony. It was before Davies Hall was built, of course. So we would go in there on Tuesday and open a program. And then we wouldn't come back until Friday, and then we would split it the weekend. So it was quite a different thing. Most of the repertory was created in-house, as some of you might remember. Michael and Lou both had a commitment that Helgi to this day shares for new work. So a lot of the works were created by Michael and Lou, of course. Robert Gladstein, who was our ballet master. Val Canaparoli got his start as a choreographer at that time. John McFall as well, who was a dancer in the company and is now an artistic director of Atlanta Ballet. So most of the works were done that way, and plus we did a heavy amount of Balanchine and then some wonderful acquisitions that Michael made during his time. We started touring again. We did a lot of touring throughout the United States, and we also did a lot of television work. Michael was very committed to that, and that was also the time that PBS had a lot of money and funding for a program called Dance in America, and they did most of the Balanchine works. They did an incredible thing at that time. But our touring was tied to our television work, of course, because we did a, Michael choreographed this kind of wonderful little production of Romeo and Juliet, which was later we broadcast on PBS Dance in America. We were the first company, American company, to do a full-length ballet on that series, which we've all been very proud of. Well, of course, that broadcast lent to a lot of touring throughout the United States at that time, and those were tough tours. And we're talking 5 weeks on a bus and moving around, and we traveled with the orchestra, but we played at a lot of universities because there was a lot of money at that time from the National Endowment for Arts. They had what was called the National Dance Touring Program. And they had a matching funding program where they would pay the sponsor part of our fee. So it was very attractive for us, and we played a lot of universities at that time. So that's kind of a snapshot of the company at that time. We did some wonderful productions. The company grew, not as quickly as it has in the last 10 years, but it grew as much as San Francisco would let it grow, because the city was growing itself. We built that wonderful building across the street here. Way. You know, so we were the first company in school in the country to build a building like that, that was designed and built specifically to house a ballet company in a school. So great, great strides were made at that time that were kind of setting the stage for Helgi's arrival in 1985 and getting everything ready for Helgi to take the company to the next place, which he's done a remarkable job of.
I think it's worth interjecting here that film of Romeo and Juliet, you played the role of Romeo.
I did.
And I assume those films are available if you just kind of know where to look.
Actually, those were done very early, you know, in the late 70s and stuff. And
let's say it was 78.
Yes. So a lot of those things, like the Balanchine programs and all those early programs that Dance in America did, the releases, you know, that all this stuff is protected. It's kind of what's happening with the writer's strike in Hollywood right now. We all were signed releases for a 3-year release that PBS could show those. And that was consistent with all the companies for years that were in those projects. So when those releases wore out, they couldn't be aired anymore. And of course, at this point, to do that, you would have to go back and find everyone that was in, you know, every dancer and all the tech people. You would have to find all those people and get them the releases signed. So hopefully, you know, someday it'll go to the next place or public domain or whatever happens, you know, and those can be accessible again. But at this point, they're just not accessible.
Oh, man. Well, I hope that does come to pass, because good grief. Of course, we know they exist archivally. So
of course, they exist archivally. Yeah. I think you can see them here, probably at Palm and in the New York, the library in New York. But, you know, in addition to our company, there were some incredible performances documenting New York City Ballet and Balanchine that he worked on personally, direction of those programs. And you had dancers like Peter Martins and Suzanne Farrell and Merrill Ashley. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff. So I think there's probably some bootleg copies floating around somewhere.
Gosh, do you think? I want to move to Filling Station. I know that you did perform it, probably in that same season, 1978, I'm guessing. But comment about it from the point of view of these folks who are going to go and see it, this run, and how did it feel at the time, and what should they look for and be affectionate?
Well, Filling Station, I think it's a wonderful work. I think it's timeless. it's funny, it's got a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's got people you can relate to. It's kind of perfect. The music's wonderful, and the history that was touched on here is, it's just so rich, and it's like a little jewel, you know, and it's so important to the ballet in America, it being the first ballet choreographed by an American on an American theme, American composer, American designer, you know, all those things. I did do the role of the socialite, the rich man, as we used to call him. I didn't do it a lot of times. The role at the time I was dancing, that role was pretty much owned by Vane Vest, who was in that film that you just saw with Paula Tracy. They played the sophisticated couple who had well, too much to drink. So I had some performances of that, but essentially the role was owned by Vane at that time, and he was wonderful in that role, as was Paula Tracy, and as was Anita Pachotti, who I think you've all met over the years, and Val Canaparoli. You know, there were a group of us that had done those roles. So it was very, you know, I'm honored to have been, you know, a small part of that in a small way. So.
Did you actually receive coaching from Lou? Did he come into the rehearsals at that time of his life and the company?
Yes, Lou was around, but the ballets, most of his ballets were overseen by Robert Gladstein, the ballet master, or Virginia Johnson, who was the ballet mistress at that time. Lou would come in at the end and kind of put the finishing touches on the works. He was older then and not real well all of the time. So, of course, when he came in the room, everything stopped and you listened to every word that Lou said, because, you know, they were his works and they were so important to San Francisco Ballet. I mean, we did Jinx and Filling Station. Of course, his Nutcracker was a wonderful, wonderful production. I don't know if any of you remember that, the Robert O'Hearn production, which is, I thought it was just beautiful. So,
I believe there's footage of that on the DVD that's in the book, I think.
I think so, yes.
Yeah. You made a very special career transition into administration, and here you are working in this amazing institution that is the school. So let's jump into that. Why administration?
Why administration? Well, I had a wonderful time as a dancer, and I don't want to replace one moment of that. I sometimes still perform with the company in character roles, and I'm very proud of that as well. But when I was coming to the end of my career, I kind of had a fascination for the way things worked. I was always kind of hanging out in the administrative end and asking questions, and I was just kind of drawn that way. I don't know why. I never had an interest to really choreograph or, you know, get in and teach that way. I have enormous respect for teaching, and I think you need to be passionate about it and devote your life to it to be successful to it, particularly at the level of our school. And I think choreography, unless you're really kind of passionate and drawn to that, you should probably stay away from it. So anyway, so at a certain point, as my dancing years were winding down, which is, it's a natural progression. It happens to all dancers. You can't physically do things for, you know, it's a short career. It's a young person's game. I was asked by Helgi at a certain point to help him out in the offices, and then there was a rather abrupt change up there, and I ended up doing the daily rehearsal schedules, which is an extremely complex job. I mean, to put together all those rehearsals in, you know, four or five studios with different choreographers and 60, 70 dancers, and, you know, everything that goes along with that. It's a very complex job that takes a lot of time and
patience,
yes, of course. I remember one comment from one of the company members. Well, first of all, everyone hates the person that does the schedule because, you know, it just ends up that way. One day, one of the dancers turned to me, and I was posting the schedule on the board. And, you know, I was kind of dancing at the same time, so it was it was a lot to juggle. And they turned to me, she looked at the schedule and looked and looked and looked to find her name and her rehearsal. And, you know, because that's how you are as a dancer. It's all about you, and it needs to be that way. You know, but when you go to the other side, you realize it's not just all about one person. So she was looking for her rehearsal, and it wasn't until, you know, 4:30 and you know, what was she going to do the rest of her day and blah, blah, blah. And she turned to me and she said, you know, I thought when you started doing this, it would be better. And I said, well, it is. Maybe not for you, but... So that's the life of the person doing the schedules. So anyway, as time wore on, I had another opportunity to go to Houston Ballet and be assistant to the managing director there. The executive director here, Joyce Moffat, was offered the job of managing director there, and she asked me to go with her. So I went there for 18 months and served in that position, and I literally did everything. I contracted choreographers and produced ballets. I wrote a manual, employee manual. I started an education program because they didn't have one there. And, you know, just it was kind of like a boot camp, you know, for administration. And then I kind of wanted to come back to San Francisco. I was born here in the Bay Area. My family's here. It's very important for me to be a part of this community. And a position came up in the school, and Helgi asked me if I would be interested in coming and working with him in the school. And I said, sure, I'll give that a try. And that was in 1995, January. So I moved back from Houston. They gave me the key to the office and handed me an itinerary, and Lola D'Avola and I were off on an audition tour for the summer program. So it just all kind of fell into place from there, and I've been there ever since. And I'm really very proud of my association with the school. I'm very proud of the school, and I'm proud to be a part of it, because, you know, when you've been... When I think about my time here and my time as a dancer and everything, it would be very easy for me to be just simply a part of the past at this organization. And I'm really proud and excited to actually be part of the future here, because that's what the school is. It's the future of San Francisco Ballet.
Can you say... Thank you. That's wonderful. Can you say how many students are in the school now? Just a few little technicalities here.
There are 360 students in the school, and that includes our Outreach Dance in Schools program, which is part of the Center for Dance Education. That includes some lower level, which we call pre-ballet, but the actual training level starts at level one with the 8-year-olds. But so there's 360 total.
Mm-hmm. And the school operates what kind of an annual cycle?
We have we operate like a regular school year. We start right around Labor Day and we end right around Memorial Day. It's a 40-week period, 38 weeks of instruction. We take a little time off for that little project known as Nutcracker. And, of course, I'm sure you're all aware, all of the children you see on the stage in the Opera House in Nutcracker are students from the school. We also operate a 5-week summer program, which happens the last week of June through the fourth week of July. And that's what I alluded to earlier when I said Lola and I took off on the audition tour. The summer program, we travel all over the United States. This year we'll visit 12 cities and audition students for that program, and they will travel here to San Francisco to study for 5 weeks. Out of that, these are intermediate and advanced level students. They stay at the dorms at USF. I mean, it's a huge, huge project. We'll have usually over 100 students staying up there, and then, you know, overall there's about 200 students in the program because our local students participate as well. But out of that group, we will invite select students to stay for the year-round program. So that's how the students in level 7 and 8, that's how we build those levels. We have students that come up through the school and go into our advanced levels, but we also bring them from the outside for their last year or two of training. There are a lot of really excellent teachers throughout the United States, but they're in smaller schools, and they can't give students, talented students, that extra finish that they need, that we can provide, because we have a whole program, you know, with fine master teachers and pas de deux classes. And, you know, for instance, a boy might be in a wonderful teacher with, in a wonderful school with a wonderful teacher, but he might be the only boy there, so he's missing this whole thing, you know. And they come here and they spend another maybe 1 or 2 years in the school, and then they'll be ready for a job either with San Francisco Ballet or other companies throughout the United States.
Talk about how many students from San Francisco Ballet School, whether they're from the bottom up or some of those that come in as older students, how many actually get into San Francisco Ballet Company?
I believe right now, I think over half of the company transitioned into transitioned through the school, and that they could have come here as children, or they could have come in the last, you know, for the last year or two of their training.
That's a pretty impressive statistic, I guess. I mean, it would be interesting to know in other companies that have associated schools, which brings up that whole concept. Talk about the associated school versus company.
Well, as you know, this is the San Francisco Ballet Association, and it's that umbrella. And under that umbrella, you know, it's governed by a board of trustees, and under that umbrella sits the company and the school. Helgi is the artistic director of the company, but he also serves as director of the school. And as director of the school, he's appointed Lola Diavola as associate director. And Helgi's role as director is the philosophical top of the school. And Lola's role as associate director is to actually set the curriculum and work with the teachers and deal with the students on a day-to-day basis. So Helgi feels very strongly. Years ago, we all know that the school was run by Harold Christensen for 35 years. Well, one or the other of his brothers were artistic directors of the company, so they were all speaking with the same voice. When Michael was here, after Harold retired, the school's director was Richard Kamek, who now has a school in Contra Costa. He did a remarkable job here as director of the school and trained many dancers who you all saw on stage for many years. But when Helgi came, he decided he would take leadership of the school because he felt very strongly that the school needed to really tie and be a part of what the company does, and it needed to be completely integrated. And if you look at the faculty of the school now, some of our teachers were former dancers with the company. I mean, Parrish Maynard is former principal dancer. Pascal Leroy was a soloist with the company for many years. Some of the other teachers also serve as character artists with the company. Jorge Esquivel, our principal male teacher, you've seen him many times in many character roles over the years. So he performs with the company, as do I. Joy Robrito also performs with the company as a character artist, and Pascal Leroy. Also, we have, many people don't know this, but many principal dancers from the company come down and actually teach in the school. During the summer session, we rely on principal dancers quite heavily to teach our point classes and variations classes to the upper levels. And then occasionally during the school year, as their schedule allows, they will come down and do the same thing, teaching the upper levels, the points and variations classes. So he feels very strongly that it needs to be all integrated. So the product of the school has the look of the same look as the company.
I've done a really terrible thing, and that is not keeping my eye on the clock. We're down to about 2 minutes. Is there anyone out here? Are there two people who have one-minute questions? Because I know that that's often where some of the most interesting information comes, is when you ask the question. Does someone have a sort of a concise question that's not going to involve a very long answer? Yes, please. How many apply to the school and how many are accepted to the school?
For this summer session audition tour, we'll see between 1,200 and 1,300 students. That's on our travels, and also we take DVD and video auditions. And as I said, we have spaces for about 200, between 200 and 225 in the program. Actually, there are probably about 120 to 125 that come from that audition tour. For the year-round program, we hold an audition every spring for students, for little students to start in the our level one, and we usually have about 80 to 100 students auditioning for those places.
And how many places are there in those levels, the younger levels?
The level one, our starting level, where we start at the eight-year-olds, there are two classes of that. The school's built like a pyramid, of course, you know, so there's lots of children, and then there's some attrition as they move through the levels that happens naturally, and also that's another subject.
Selectively, yeah.
Those levels might have between 15 and 18 in them, each of them. So there's between 30 and 35 spots to fill.
One more question, and please speak up. Interesting. How many are in those two upper levels, 7 and 8, and how many are non-residents?
This year we have about 45 students between those two levels. It changes, you know, depending on the year. Non-residents, let's see. I would venture to say that over half of those are non-residents. That have come from the summer program, yeah.
And the school actually has a residence for out-of-town students, correct?
We do. We have a house in Pacific Heights where we can house 24 students. We started that about 4 years ago, and it's just been such a wonderful thing to happen in the school. It's the greatest thing to happen in the school in decades, actually, since we moved into that building. Because what happened was the students who came wanted to come to the school for the year-round program, and, you know, in our level 7 and 8 were kind of renting apartments and, you know, living two and three kids in a studio, or the mother would come or the father would come and live with the student for a year. And what this has done is it's made it much easier and safer for students to come and be a part of San Francisco Ballet School.
I hate it. We're going to have to wrap things up. I want to, before, you know, hold your applause for just a moment, I really want to say thank you very much to Jim Sohm, who is the administrative manager, if I got that correct.
That is correct.
Administrative manager of the San Francisco Ballet School, to remind you all that you can go to the website, sfballet.org, check for anniversary activities, check for podcasts of the Meet the Artist interviews as well as these. With that said, I hope that you will all rush off and enjoy this evening's performance or another performance in the next few weeks. Thank you so much for coming, and Jim.